New Russia, much as British colonizers spoke of a New England, a New South Wales, and so on. In that age of empire, regions inhabited by people other than the colonizers were new from the colonial perspective. New meant that the region had not always belonged to the empire. Such places did not necessarily remain with the colonial power. New England and New South Wales are not parts of Britain, just as New Russia is not part of Russia. As Surkov and Glazyov tried to organize armed rebellions in southeastern Ukraine in March 2014, maps of Novorossiya flooded Russian television screens. They displayed a span of territory that, if taken by Russia, would separate Ukraine from its ports on the Black Sea and unite occupied Crimea, which has no land connection to Russia, with the territory of the Russian Federation. The Russian army gathered in March in the two Russian districts that bordered Ukraine, Belgorod and Rostov. The basic idea, consistent with Moscow's plans that February, was to organize forceful takeovers of regional administration buildings in eight further Ukrainian districts, have followers declare secession from within those buildings, and make Ukraine disintegrate from within. And so, in spring 2014, Russian political technologists arrived in Ukraine on a second mission. After Crimea, the much more ambitious and vaguely defined domination of the Ukrainian southeast. Alexander Borodai was made responsible for the political entities that Russia would subsidize. As Borodai explained, in invading Ukraine, we are fighting for the global Russian idea. His friend Girkin was to handle the military operation in the southeast. He surfaced in April 2014 in the city of Slovyansk. Moscow denied that Borodai and Girkin were its men, or that they were in Ukraine, or both. For Girkin's GRU men in the field in Ukraine, this denial was annoying and, in the end, too much to take. As they set up field headquarters in Slovyansk on April 17th, Russian soldiers were irritated that locals believed the Russian propaganda that they were volunteers. "We are special forces from the GRU." The Ukrainian state was meanwhile under great pressure. Crimea had been occupied by Russia. Russian soldiers were in the southeast. Some citizens had high expectations after a revolution that others had opposed. Presidential elections had to be organized. Even so, the Russian attempt to seize Novorossiya collapsed by summer. The Russian coups in Ukrainian regional capitals in March and April mostly failed. As a rule, when Russians and local Confederates tried to stage occupations of regional administration buildings, nothing much happened. To be sure, Ukrainian citizens in these southeastern regions were more likely to list Russian rather than Ukrainian as their first language, more likely to have voted for Yanukovych in 2010, and less likely to have been present on the Maidan. Yet this did not mean that they supported Russian rule or changes of regime by outside forces. After the annexation of Crimea, the campaign for Novorossiya had success in only two of the eight districts concerned, and only in parts of these, Luhansk and Donetsk. Together known as the Donbass, these regions had coal, which Russia did not need. But both bordered the Russian Federation, and their local oligarchs hesitated at crucial moments. Russia failed to get a foothold in regions of much greater interest, such as Kharkiv, Odessa, and Dnipropetrovsk. Kharkiv and Odessa were areas that Russians regarded as centers of Russian culture, and Dnipropetrovsk was a hub of the two countries' shared military-industrial complex. Dnipropetrovsk became a center of resistance to the Russian invasion under its new governor, Ihor Kolomoisky, who put a bounty on the head of Russian soldiers. Although the Russian flag was briefly raised over Kharkiv by a young Russian who liked to climb buildings and take selfies, the regional administration building was returned to Ukrainian control the same day. In Odessa, the initial attempt to storm the regional administration building also failed. In March and April, local Odessans prepared for a Russian invasion. Prominent local citizens sent an appeal to Putin, explaining that they did not need Russian protection. Others took part in paramilitary training so that they could resist Russian special forces if they arrived. Russian television insisted, day after day, that Ukrainian nationalists were going to storm the province and wreak havoc, although no such thing was happening or would happen. Some Odessans, along with some Russian citizens, marched on May 1st to chant their support for Novorossiya. The next day, pro-Russian and pro-Ukrainian groups fought on the streets, both sides armed, the pro-Ukrainian side more numerous. people on each side threw Molotov cocktails. When some of the pro-Russian fighters withdrew to a building known as the House of Professors, the battle of Molotov cocktails continued there. The building caught fire, killing a number of the pro-Russian protesters. So ended this particular Russian attempt to inspire internal rebellion within Ukraine. Prokhanov compared Russia's failed coup in Odessa to the Holocaust. An anti-Semite invoked the mass murder of the Jews to justify an offensive war. The politics of eternity consumes the substance of the past, leaving only a boundless innocence that justifies everything. By May 2014, disaster was looming for Russia, even in the parts of the Luhansk and Donetsk regions under Russian control. The small Ukrainian army was more than sufficient to humiliate Girkin's GRU mission in Slovyansk and defeat the Russian volunteers and Ukrainian separatists whom he had managed to gather. Girkin pled for local help. "I admit that I never expected to find that in the entire region one cannot find even 1,000 men willing to risk their lives for their own city. It seemed as if all of the Donetsk and Luhansk regions would soon return to Ukrainian control. A meaningful response to the Ukrainian advance would require more Russian assistance. So the Vostok Battalion, composed largely of Chechens, crossed into Ukraine from Russia. On May 26th, its men, together with volunteers from Russia, stormed the Donetsk airport. They were beaten back by Ukrainian defenders and took considerable losses. At least 31 Russian volunteers died in the failed assault. They had left their friends and families behind in Russia because of the media fictions of fascism and genocide in Novorossiya. Their deaths went unmentioned in major Russian media. Maria Turchinkova, a Russian journalist who accompanied the corpses on the journey from Ukraine back to Russia for burial, made the point succinctly. "Not a single one of the domestic television channels, which for months have been creating a public notion of a genocide against Russians in eastern Ukraine, have reported that 31 Russians were killed in Donetsk on 26 May. One of these 31 was Evgeny Korolenko. He needed money and had told his wife that he had perspectives in the Donbas. Then his wife saw the photograph of his corpse on the internet. Her first and natural reaction was to deny to herself that it was him. 'It doesn't look like him,' she thought. But then she looked again. The chain that he wore, the shape of his nose. His corpse, along with the others, was brought to the city of Rostov. An undertaker refused to take the body, fearing it would be seen as a provocation. 'Please understand, this is a citizen of Russia who fell in combat, and our country is not at war.' From a figure of authority, she received this characterization of her situation. 'You are a mature person. Russia is not carrying out any organized military activities. Your husband went under fire voluntarily in that street.'" By the end of June 2014, authorities in Moscow had all but ceased to speak of Novorossiya and had shifted to the strategy of making the parts of the Donbas it occupied a permanent source of instability for the Ukrainian state. Some of the Chechens killed in Vostok were replaced by Ossetians, who seemed to think that they had been sent to fight the United States. The name Vostok was preserved as the battalion accepted local Ukrainian citizens who found reasons to fight against the Ukrainian state. Some of them were former Ukrainian security officers who were ideologically motivated, such as Alexander Khodorkovsky, who said, "We are not really fighting for ourselves here, but for Russia." But it seems that most Ukrainian citizens who fought on the Russian side were drawn into the conflict by the experience of violence, the shelling of cities that resulted from Russia's choice to fight a partisan war. On July 5th, facing defeat by the Ukrainian army, Girkin made the move that Putin had recommended. He turned the local population into human shields. He withdrew his men to Donetsk, and other GRU commanders did the same. This guaranteed, as Girkin noted, that civilians would become the main victims of the war. The Ukrainian side fought Russians and their local allies by shelling cities, while the Russians did the same. In the terminology of partisan war, this was the shift from positive to negative mobilization. If no one wants to fight for the partisan cause as such, positive motivation, then a partisan commander creates conditions in which the enemy kills civilians, negative motivation. This was Girkin's chosen tactic, as he himself said. One of his Russian interviewers correctly described Girkin as a man who would willingly sacrifice the lives of women and children to advance a military goal. Destroying cities to win recruits was indeed Girkin's signal achievement. Naturally, Ukrainian citizens in the Donbas did not consider the totality of the situation as the shells exploded. Many blamed the Ukrainian army for using heavy weapons against Ukrainian cities. In interviews, parents spoke of their children learning to distinguish the types of artillery from the sounds of their shells. One mother joined the Russian fight against the Ukrainian army after the yard where her child normally played was hit by a shell. Over and over, Ukrainian citizens who joined the separatists in summer 2014 said that it was the death of women, children, and the aged from artillery that inspired them to take up arms. A survey suggested that this experience, rather than an ideology such as separatism or Russian nationalism, was the main motivation of Ukrainian citizens who chose to fight against the Ukrainian army. Seeing violent death made people vulnerable to stories that imparted to these deaths some larger sense. These stories were provided by Russian television. It was impossible to know who had launched the shell that landed in your neighborhood. Russian television, all that was available in the parts of Ukraine controlled by Russia, blamed the Ukrainian side. As one Ukrainian citizen who fought on the Russian side remembered, the instruction that the Ukrainian army was a genocidal collective made it easier to think of individual Ukrainian soldiers as beings in human form who could and should be shot. Once separatists had brought about the same kind of death that they had seen, the stories of innocence became unimpeachable truth. It is hard to resist lies for which one has already killed. Having brought the Donbas to this point by summer 2014, Girkin was withdrawn to Russia. The new head of security, Vladimir Antyufeyev, was Russia's leading specialist in the form of geopolitical theater known as frozen conflict. In a frozen conflict, Russia occupies small parts of a nearby country, Moldova since 1991, Georgia since 2008, Ukraine since 2014, and then presents its own occupation as an internal problem that prevents its neighbors from having closer relations with the European Union or NATO. In a frozen conflict, the sentiments of local people matter only as a political resource. Locals can be encouraged to kill and die, but their own aspirations cannot be fulfilled, since the point of freezing a conflict is to prevent any resolution. Antyufeyev had spent the previous stage of his career in Transnistria, a section of Moldova occupied by Russian soldiers, where he had been in charge of security for the unrecognized mini-state. His arrival in Donetsk heralded a similar future for the Donetsk People's Republic. It was to exist, Antyufeyev announced, in permanent limbo. He called it an independent state, though he also said that no one, including Russia, would recognize it as such. Unification with Russia was also not a question for today. For Antyufeyev, the desires of the people of the Donbas were subordinate to the prerogatives of a far grander struggle against the European Union and the United States, which he portrayed as the satanic West. He promised an offensive that would turn the tide in this global war. The Soviet Union had not collapsed, he said, because of its own problems, but because the West had deployed mysterious destructive technologies. This phrase, as in the Izborsk Club manifesto, meant facts. The Russian invasion of Ukraine, Antyufeyev said, must be understood as the self-defense of innocent Russians from an alliance between the Freemasons of Europe and the United States and the fascists of Ukraine. Antyufeyev had mastered schizofascism. Russia was at war against fascists, but these fascists were somehow in league with international Freemasons. The idea of a global conspiracy of Masons is fascist. Antyufeyev was using this fascist portrayal of the world to present himself as an anti-fascist. Since Ukraine was the focus of the efforts of the global anti-Russian conspiracy, victory there, Antyufeyev thought, might change the world. The Russian intervention in Ukraine, Antyufeyev explained, was a defense of Russia's natural gas and fresh water from a rapacious United States. It was all one struggle, but it could be won. In Antyufeyev's view, Ukraine is a disintegrating state, exactly like the United States. The destruction of the United States was both desirable and inevitable. If the world were saved from demonic constructions such as the United States, it would be easier for everyone to live. And one of these days, it will happen. The Russian counterattack against the Ukrainian army was launched in July 2014 from the territory of the Russian Federation. It began with massive artillery barrages launched from the Russian side of the border. Yevgeny Zhukov, one of the Ukrainian soldiers clearing a stretch of the border in Luhansk region, recorded the consequences of the first Russian artillery barrage of July 11th. Writing on his Facebook page that evening, he wished to correct reports that he and his men had been in a battle. That was not the case. They had been targeted, as he correctly stated, in a carefully prepared, precisely rehearsed, and successful artillery strike on our military base at the Luhansk border from the Russian side. He described as many of the 79 people who were killed as he could. At the end of his post, he offered them all a low bow. Zhukov was describing the first strike in a massive Russian artillery campaign directed against the Ukrainian army. It lasted for 4 weeks. Until August 8th, Russian artillery fired regularly from at least 66 positions on the Russian side of the border. Units such as Zhukov's were helpless. Ukraine was at a permanent disadvantage in the information war. Some European and American observers were still uncertain that a war was going on, or that Russia was the aggressor. In this fog of stupefaction, a Ukrainian attack on Russian territory would have been a political disaster. And so the information war determined the conditions of the war on the ground. Russia could shell Ukraine from its own territory without consequences, but Ukraine could not consider responding in kind. Some Ukrainian soldiers under artillery fire even fled across the border to Russia because they knew that Russian territory would be safe. Meanwhile, Russian journalists at the Russian-Ukrainian border had no difficulty in seeing that Russia is shelling Ukraine from Russian territory. Russian citizens in the border zone took videos of Russian soldiers in action. The Russian soldier Vadim Grigoryev, stationed in Matyevo Kurgan in Russia, posted proudly that, "All night we pounded Ukraine." Armies usually evacuate civilians from an artillery range so that they will not be killed by the enemy's return fire. Russian authorities gave no such orders, presumably because they were confident no counterstrike was coming. Children on the Russian side of the border, unlike children on the Ukrainian side of the border, learned to sleep through shelling. It was not directed at them. Some local Russians felt ill at ease about this one-way war, in which their farmsteads were used to rain down death on people not so different from themselves. But a sense of safety, combined with television propaganda, helped to resolve guilt. "It's awful, but we've understood already that the shooting is not at us, but from us. And if the shooting is from us, it must be right and good. Our people are cleansing the border of fascists." "After all," said a local Russian, "if Nazis are committing genocide on the Ukrainian side, then such unusual measures must be justified." The Russian journalists who reported on the shelling were placing themselves at risk. One of them, Elena Rachova, found herself speaking to FSB officers in Kuibyshevo as the daily cannonade began. "Is that a Grad?" she asked, after they had all paused to listen to the roar characteristic of that artillery piece. All the FSB men smiled. "It was thunder," said one. "I didn't hear a thing," said a second. "It was my wife calling," was the joke of a third. "It's a military salute," was the final witticism. "You understand," said Rachova, "that I can write about this." And the threatening reply, "And then my colleagues will come and explain more persuasively that this was a salute." The Ukrainian army could not shell Russia, but it could shell Russian soldiers and their allies inside Ukraine. The Russian artillery campaign began only 6 days after Girkin withdrew his men to the city of Donetsk and continued thereafter for 3 more weeks. As Ukrainian soldiers were cut to pieces by Russian grads firing from Russia, their comrades did not hesitate to aim their own grads at Ukrainian cities where Russian soldiers, Russian volunteers, and their local allies were hiding. "The shelling so far in Donetsk," admitted Girkin, "I am responsible." The Russian journalist Natalia Telegina distinguished the fable of television, where heroic soldiers defend civilians, from the artillery war she saw. "But that reality exists only on television screens, not around you. Around you is simply war, where both sides are shooting, and no one spares the civilian population." That was a fact. One day after Russia began shelling Ukraine, Russian television provided a compelling escalation in the competition for innocence. On July 12, 2014, Первый канал told a stirring and entirely fictional story of a 3-year-old Russian boy who was crucified by Ukrainian soldiers in Slovyansk. No evidence was provided. An independent Russian journalist noted the story's problems. None of the people in the story existed, nor did the Lenin Square where the atrocity supposedly transpired. When confronted with this, Russia's deputy minister for communications, Alexei Volin, said that ratings were all that mattered. People watched the crucifixion, so all was well. It seems that Alexander Dugin personally invented the crucifixion, a version of which had already appeared on his personal social media. The image of a murdered innocent made Russia the Christ of nations, and its war of aggression a response to diabolical cruelty. The purpose of the Russian intervention was nominally to protect speakers of Russian, or, as Putin said, the Russian world. Since everyone on all sides of the conflict spoke Russian, the Russian intervention was killing Russian speakers rather than protecting them. The inconvenience of the factual was overcome by what Dugin liked to call an archetype, the killing of Jesus. A bloody and confusing war started by flawed Russian leaders that killed thousands of Russian speakers became the martyrdom of an innocent Russian body. Russian television was the instrument of implausible deniability. It denied the presence of Russian special forces, secret services, commanders, volunteers, and weapons. Prominent Russian citizens such as Girkin, Borodai, and Antiofeyev appeared on Russian television screens, described as activists of Novorossiya or administrators of the Donetsk People's Republic. The same Russian television channels that claimed Russian soldiers were Ukrainian volunteers released video of men at war in Ukraine with what were unmistakably advanced Russian weapon systems. The most modern Russian tanks, not available for foreign sale and never before seen outside Russia, appeared on Ukrainian territory. Russians were not meant to decide the factual question of whether or not their army was in Ukraine, which was obviously the case. They were meant to follow the cues of a television drama. If the voiceover instructed that Russians and their weapons were local, then that was the story to be followed. A crucial Russian weapon system delivered from Russia and deployed by Russian soldiers was anti-aircraft batteries. These changed the course of the war in May and June 2014. The Ukrainian army, small as it was routing the Russians and their local allies so long as it maintained control of the air. In May, Russia began to supply anti-aircraft weapons and the teams that operated them, and the Ukrainian Air Force was quickly depleted. 4 helicopters were shot down. In June, 2 fixed-wing aircraft were shot down. In July, 4 fixed-wing aircraft. The Ukrainian command had to cease flying over the Donbas, which gave the Russians their chance. One of the numerous Russian military convoys left its base in Kursk on June 23, 2014. It was a detachment of the Russian 53rd Air Defense Brigade, bound for Donetsk with a Buk anti-aircraft missile system marked 332. On the morning of July 17th, this Buk system was hauled from Donetsk to Snizhne, then brought under its own power to a farmstead south of that town. Meanwhile, Malaysia Airlines Flight 17, bound for Kuala Lumpur from Amsterdam, was crossing over southeastern Ukraine. It was flying on an authorized route at the normal altitude, in regular contact with air traffic controllers, until a ground-to-air missile suddenly destroyed it. At 1:20 p.m., Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 was struck by hundreds of high-energy metal projectiles released from the explosion of a 9N314M warhead carried by a missile fired from that Russian Buk launcher at Snizhne. The projectiles ripped through the cockpit and instantly killed the pilots, from whose corpses some of the metal was later extracted. The aircraft flew apart 10 kilometers above the Earth's surface, its passengers and their possessions scattered over a radius of 50 kilometers. Girkin boasted that his people had shot down another plane over our sky, and other commanders made similar remarks. Alexander Khodorkovsky told the press that a Russian Buk was active in the theater at the time. The Buk was hastily withdrawn from Ukraine back to Russia and photographed along the way with an empty missile silo. What had happened was quite clear. The law of gravity seemed to challenge, at least for a few hours on the afternoon of July 17, 2014, the laws of eternity. surely the passengers who died were the victims, not the Russian soldiers who fired the missile. Even the Russian ambassador to the United Nations was thrown for a moment, using the excuse of confusion to explain how a Russian weapon had brought down a civilian airliner. Yet Surkov's apparatus acted quickly to restore the Russian sense of innocence. In a typical mark of tactical brilliance, Russian television never denied the actual course of events, that a Malaysian airliner had been brought down by a Russian weapon fired by Russian soldiers taking part in an invasion of Ukraine. Denying the obvious only suggests it. Defeating the obvious means engaging it from the flanks. Even under stress, Russian media managers had the presence of mind to try to change the subject by inventing fictional versions of what had happened. On the very day the plane was shot down, all the major Russian channels blamed a Ukrainian missile, or perhaps a Ukrainian aircraft, for the downing of MH17, and claimed that the real target had been the president of Russia. The Ukrainian government, according to the Russian media, had planned to assassinate Putin, but by accident had shot down the wrong aircraft. None of this was vaguely plausible. The two planes were not in the same place. The failed assassination story was so ludicrous that RT, after trying it on foreign audiences, did not pursue it. But within Russia itself, the moral calculus was indeed reversed. By the end of a day on which Russian soldiers had killed 298 foreign civilians during a Russian invasion of Ukraine, it had been established that Russia was the victim. The following day, July 18, 2014, Russian television scattered new versions of the event. Myriad inventions were added to the multiple fictions, not to make any of them coherent, but to introduce further doubts about simpler and more plausible accounts. Thus, three Russian television channels claimed that Ukrainian air traffic controllers had asked the pilots of MH17 to reduce their altitude. This was a lie. One of the networks then claimed that Ihor Kolomoisky, the Ukrainian Jewish oligarch who was governor of the Dnipropetrovsk region, was personally responsible for issuing the fictional order to the air traffic controllers. In an echo of Nazi racial profiling, another network later provided an expert on physiognomy who claimed that Kolomoisky's face demonstrated his guilt. Meanwhile, five Russian television networks, including some that had peddled the air traffic control story, claimed that Ukrainian fighter aircraft had been on the scene. They could not get straight just which kind of aircraft this might have been, providing pictures of various jets taken at various places and times, and proposing altitudes that were impossible for the aircraft in question. The claim about the presence of fighter planes was untrue. A week after the disaster, Russian television generated a third version of the story of the downing of MH17. Ukrainian forces had shot it down during training exercises. This, too, had no basis in fact. Girkin then added a fourth version, claiming that Russia had indeed shot down MH17, but that no crime had been committed since the CIA had filled the plane with corpses and sent it over Ukraine to provoke Russia. These fictions were raised to the rank of Russian foreign policy. When asked about MH17, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov repeated the inventions of Russian media about air traffic controllers and nearby Ukrainian fighters. Neither of his claims was backed by evidence, and both were untrue. Russian media accounts were impossible, not only as journalism, but also as literature. If one tried to accept, one by one, the claims of Russian television, the fictional world thus constructed would be impossible, since its various elements could not coexist. It could not have been the case that the plane was shot down both from the ground and from the air. If it had been shot down from the air, it could not have been shot down by both a MiG and an Su-25. If it had been shot down from the ground, this could not have been the result of both a training accident and an assassination attempt. Indeed, the Putin assassination story contradicted everything else that the Russian media claimed. It made no sense to say that Ukrainian air traffic controllers had communicated with the Malaysian pilots of MH17 as part of a plot to shoot down the Russian presidential aircraft. But even if all of these lies could not make a coherent story, they could at least break a story, one that happened to be true. Although there were certainly individual Russians who grasped what had happened and apologized, the Russian population as a whole was denied the possibility to reflect on its responsibility for a war and its crimes. According to the surveys of the one reliable sociological institute in Russia, in September 2014, 86% of Russians blamed Ukraine for shooting down MH17, and 85% continued to do so in July 2015, by which point the actual course of events had been investigated and was clear. Russian media urged Russians to be outraged that they were blamed. Ignorance begat innocence, and the politics of eternity went on. Russians who watched television in summer 2014 learned nothing of the Russian artillery that continued to pound Ukrainian positions, nor of the Russian invasion force assembled at the Ukrainian border. As in Crimea in February, the face of Russia at war during the summer campaign would be a biker gang. On August 9, 2014, the day after the Ukrainian army had fled the border under Russian shelling, the Night Wolves staged a motorcycle exhibition in Sevastopol, a Ukrainian city that Russia had annexed along with Crimea. RT described it for Europeans and Americans as an epic Night Wolves biker rally. In fact, the motorcycle tricks were mediocre and secondary. Most important was the long, televised introduction, which brought fascist themes to millions of Russians. The Sevastopol bike show began in darkness in a vast hall. A spotlight revealed Alexander Zaldostanov, the leader of the Night Wolves, as he was raised towards the rafters in a cargo elevator. Wearing a bandana and a leather vest over tight black clothing, he began to intone. "My motherland delivered 10 Stalinist blows to fascism's hirsute body. Even as the earth settled on the graves of 30 million heroes, even as the cinders of the burned villages still glowed, Stalin gave the order to plant orchards. And among the flowering orchards, we rebuilt the devastated cities, and we thought that the flowering would never end." Zaldostanov was reciting Alexander Prokhanov's manifesto of a few months earlier, Our New Victory Day. In that text, Prokhanov was rehabilitating Stalinism by associating it with victory in the Second World War and justifying the Russian invasion of Ukraine by claiming that it was like the defense of the Soviet Union against Nazi Germany. Rather than a Soviet republic that was invaded by Germany, rather than the main target of Hitler's colonial plans, rather than the major battlefield of the Second World War, rather than a land that lost 3 million soldiers and another 3 million civilians to the German occupation, Ukraine suddenly became a wartime enemy of Russia. In his text, Prokhanov made the war between Russian innocence and Western decadence explicitly sexual, dreaming of flowering without deflowering. At just this point in Zaldostanov's recitation, the stage lights came on to reveal Russia's pregnant virgins, a group of women with pillows under their clothes to create a baby bulge, others pushing empty prams. Prokhanov blamed Russia's problems on foreigners who intervened in what he called the nightmarish 1990s. His text implored Russians to ignore the facts around them and to fall instead into a trance before the icon of the red flower. He meant that the Soviet victory in the Second World War made Russians innocent of all wrongdoing for all time. Russians, as they dismember Ukraine, should bow down before the blossom in sensuous worship. And on this icon, once again, the scarlet blossom began to open, a marvelous scarlet bud. We inhaled its scent, drank in its marvelous juices. The invasion of Crimea was a climax. As a gift for our patience and stoicism, our labor and faith, God has sent us Crimea. The Russian people, once divided by enemies, are again united in victorious embraces. Then Prokhanov, intoned by the biker Zaldostanov to a live audience of tens of thousands and to a televised audience of millions, specified his fear of penetration. The enemy of the Russian idol was the giant black penis of Satan. Barack Obama was at this time the president of the United States. Taking for granted the myth that Kiev was the site of Russia's virgin birth, Prokhanov imagined its cathedral as a Russian holy of holies. He then fantasized about a diabolical orgasm. The black sperm of fascism splashed upon Kiev, the mother of all Russian cities. In the golden apse of Saint Sophia, among the temples and shrines, was conceived a deformed embryo with a hairy face and black horns, like the devil in a church fresco. In Prokhanov's fantasy, fascism was thus not an ideology or an aesthetic. If fascism were such things, the spectacle of a man in black leather intoning a message of national blamelessness and necessary war would be its perfect instantiation. For the schizofascists, Fascism was a substance from the dissolute outside world that threatened the virginal Russian organism. Like a decadent dough, it overflowed its Kiev bowl and spread through all Ukraine. Ultimately to blame for this unspeakable aggression were Barack Obama and Angela Merkel, who smell of burnt flesh. This last gesture of Prohanov's was the normal closing flourish of schizofascist prose, a fascist text written by an anti-Semite to justify a war of aggression, exploits the symbols of the Holocaust, here the ovens of Auschwitz-Birkenau, to direct blame towards others. The travesty was intentional. Prohanov's invocation of black sperm was a profanation of the most justly famous poem of the Holocaust, Paul Celan's Death Fugue. Ukrainian society and Ukrainian history were dismissed or suppressed in every line of Prohanov's manifesto, read by Zadostanov, as Russian artillery shells were exploding in Ukraine, and as Russian soldiers handed in their phones and checked their weapons while they prepared to cross the Ukrainian border. Kiev was not a Ukrainian city, though it was the capital of Ukraine. Ukraine was an enemy, although Ukrainians suffered more than Russians during the Second World War. The Maidan was not a civic protest, but a demonic bastard born of the rape of Virgin Russia by Black Satan. The drastic images had to overwhelm the prosaic reality of people who wanted the future with the rule of law. The political preliminaries to the bike show went on and on. "A new battle against fascism is inevitable," pronounced Zadostanov. "The 11th Stalinist blow is inevitable." Then from the loudspeakers resounded the recorded voices of Obama, Merkel, and Hitler. On the stage, beneath a tarp, a shape began to move, summoned by the voices, the dough overflowing its bowl. From beneath the tarp emerged black figures who danced in the form of a swastika. Then giant mechanical hands appeared above the stage, one finger bearing a ring with an eagle, the American puppet master. The black figures became Ukrainian protesters who attacked helpless riot police. Zadostanov condemned Europe's eternal lackeys, its spiritual slaves. Then the leader of the black demonstrators was lynched. All of this gave the Russian band Trinadsat Sozvezdia time to prepare its nationalist ska favorite, "Why Do Ukrainians Kill Other Ukrainians?" The lyrics asked why Rus had been sold to Europe, an odd question, since Rus was a medieval European realm. As Trinadsat Sozvezdia showed, popular culture could invoke the politics of eternity. Russia was Rus, history never was, invasion is self-defense. In the band's determined, if unartful, presentation, Ukrainians of today could not have chosen Europe, because Ukraine was Rus and Rus was Russia. Ukrainians must have been manipulated. Who lied to you today, Ukraine? Cued by the song, two armored vehicles with Ukrainian markings appeared at the center of the stage and appeared to burn people to death. Heroic Russian volunteers fired thousands of machine gun rounds at the vehicles while rappelling down cords hung from the rafters. Victorious, the Russian volunteers claimed the vehicles and waved the flags of the Donetsk People's Republic. Zadostanov then spoke again. He linked the existence of Ukraine to the German invasion of the Soviet Union by asking for forgiveness from Red Army soldiers sleeping in mass graves who, responding to a summons, covered roofs with their hearts. It mattered not at all that a very large number of those Red Army soldiers had been Ukrainians. Russia needed a monopoly on martyrdom. In order to preserve it, Russia would make war on a nation with a far greater record of suffering, the Ukrainians, while abusing the memory of a people with a still greater record of victimhood, the Jews. As the rap group Opasnia now explained in their song Donbass, Ukrainians needed fraternal assistance from Big Brother Russia. Fraternal assistance had been Brezhnev's term for military interventions to sustain communist regimes in other countries. When this song was over, Zadostanov called for the conquest of more Ukrainian territory by Russia. The motorcycle exhibition at long last began. Like the preceding ska and rap, the stunts were an unremarkable example of a North American art form. The bike show was exceptional only in its rehabilitation of a long discredited European art form, the Nazi Gesamtkunstwerk, the total work of art meant to replace world with worldview, and history with eternity. The Crucifixion, July 10th, the MH17 Cacophony, July 17th, and the Bike Show, August 9th, were only three examples of the televised propaganda to which Russians were exposed in the summer of 2014. This creative ignorance invited Russians into a sense of innocence. It is hard to know what effect all of this had on Russian citizens in general. It certainly persuaded men to travel to Ukraine to fight. After Russian artillery had cleared sections of the border of Ukrainian troops by August 8th, the way was open for still larger deployments of Russian volunteers and weapons. As Russian recruiters said, even as Russian spokesmen denied it abroad, the Russian government used unmarked white trucks, which it called humanitarian, as troop transports. Russian volunteers started their journey because of what they had seen on Russian television about the war in Ukraine. One recruiter, a Special Forces veteran, explained, "Our press and television present the dramatic facts." Some of these Russian volunteers assumed that Ukraine did not exist. One Russian from distant Asia, from the point where Russia meets China, Mongolia, and Kazakhstan, declared that Russians and Ukrainians were a single people. Real for these men, by contrast, was Novorossiya, a construct vanishing from Russian television screens even as the volunteers arrived in Ukraine. Some volunteers imagined that they were preventing the United States from starting a world war, others that they were hindering global Sodom. When asked why they fought, Russian volunteers spoke of fascism and genocide. The Crucifixion proved unforgettable. Young men spoke of a call of the heart to rescue children. Russian volunteers arriving at the frontier were massively outnumbered by regular Russian troops. In July and August 2014, Russian officers were giving orders to Russian soldiers at 23 camps established near the Ukrainian border. By early August, elements of about 30 units of the Russian armed forces had encamped at the frontier and made their preparations for an invasion of Ukraine. Russian villagers grew accustomed to the presence of young recruits from all over Russia, just as they had gotten used to the sound of artillery fire. Every now and then, the soldiers might attract attention. Young men who were about to go under hostile fire can behave unusually in the days before. On the night of August 11th, for example, the villagers of Koibyshevo, just on the Russian side of the border, watched some unfamiliar dancing. The dancers were soldiers of the 136th Motorized Infantry Brigade based in Buynask, Dagestan, a Muslim-majority district of the Russian Federation in the Caucasus bordering Chechnya, a place where less than 5% of the population is Russian. Like many of the soldiers of the Russian Federation sent to kill and die in Ukraine, these soldiers were members of non-Russian ethnic minorities, men whose deaths would not register in media markets. Not long after August 11th, the 136th Motorized crossed the Russian-Ukrainian border and engaged the Ukrainian army. By August 22nd, the corpses of the dancers were arriving in Dagestan. The 18th Separate Motorized Rifle Brigade, based in Chechnya, was one of the first Russian units to cross during the summer invasion. It was composed largely of refugees from Russia's wars in Chechnya, and had just seen action in Crimea. On July 23rd, 6 days after Russia shot down MH17, its men got their orders to report to their base in Chechnya. 3 days later, they were on their way to a camp at the Russian-Ukrainian border. On August 10th, one of the unit's soldiers, Anton Tumanov, told his mother that they are sending us to Ukraine. The next day, he was given ammunition and grenades. He posted on VKontakte, the Russian equivalent of Facebook, "They took my phone, and I went to Ukraine." Tumanov was one of about 1,200 comrades from the 18th Separate Motorized who entered Ukraine on August 12th. On August 13th, the men of the 18th Separate Motorized were in Snizhne, where 4 weeks earlier Russian soldiers had shot down MH17. Ukrainian artillery fire set their ammunition dump aflame, killing some 120 men and wounding about 450 more. Anton Tumanov's family received a report. The place of death was listed as location of unit, the time of death as time of performing military service, the cause of death as blood loss after having lost his legs. His mother learned more about how her son died because one of his comrades took the risk of telling her. "What I don't understand," Chumanov's mother said, is what he died for. Why couldn't we let people in Ukraine sort things out for themselves? It pained her that her son was killed in a war that was not officially taking place. If they sent our soldiers there, let them admit it. When she posted the facts of her son's death on social media, she was attacked as a traitor. Konstantin Kuzmin, another soldier of the 18th Separate Motorized, probably died at the same time. He had called his parents in a rush on August 8th. Mama, Papa, I love you. Hi to everyone. Kiss my daughter for me. His mother was told 9 days later by an emissary of the Russian army that her son had died in exercises on the Ukrainian border. When she asked, do you believe the words you are telling me? He had the decency to reply that he did not. One of Kuzmin's comrades, the tank driver Rufat Oranyazov, survived that artillery strike of August 13th. His girlfriend was able to follow the progress of his unit through social media and knew about the artillery strike and fatalities. The next day, he called her to say that many of ours have died before my eyes. After August 14th, he never called again. We were waiting for marriage, his girlfriend remembered. Whenever I said something, he smiled. On or about August 17, 2014, elements of the 76th Air Assault Division, based in Pskov, crossed into Ukraine. Of the 2,000 or so of its men deployed against the Ukrainian army, about 100 were killed in action. The funerals in Pskov began on August 24th. People who tried to photograph the graves were chased away. On August 19th, the 137th Parachute Regiment of the 106th Airborne Guards, based in Ryazan, joined the invasion. Sergei Andrianov was killed in action not long thereafter. Forgive me, my son, wrote his mother, but I could not shelter you from this evil war. A friend posted on VKontakte, may he who sent you to fight in a foreign land be damned. The 31st Airborne Assault Brigade, based in Ulyanovsk, had been summoned for training on August 3rd. Its men knew that they would be sent to Ukraine. Everything was following the pattern of their recent deployment to Crimea. One of them, Nikolai Kozlov, had spent his time in Crimea in a Ukrainian police uniform, apparently as part of Russia's deception campaign. By August 24th, the 31st Airborne had entered Ukrainian territory. On that day, Kozlov lost his leg in a Ukrainian attack. At least two of his comrades, Nikolai Bushin and Ilmor Kilchenbaev, were killed in action. The Ukrainian army took 10 soldiers of this unit prisoner, including Ruslan Akhmetov and Arseniy Ilmitov. At about the same time, on or about August 14th, Russia's 6th Separate Tank Brigade, based in the Nizhegorod region, joined the battle in Ukraine. Its soldiers posed for photographs in front of Ukrainian road signs. Vladislav Barakov was killed in action in his tank, and at least two of his comrades were taken prisoner by the Ukrainian army. At some point in August 2014, the 200th Motorized Infantry Brigade, based in Pechenga, entered the battle for the city of Luhansk, the second city after Donetsk of the Donbass. The young men of the 200th Motorized painted For Stalin, USSR, and the hammer and sickle on their tanks, and Death to Fascism on their howitzers. A self-propelled artillery piece was christened Stalin's Fist, a reference to the 11th Stalinist blow that Prokhanov had promised. On one Grad artillery piece, the soldiers wrote, For Children and Mothers, and on another, Children of Donetsk. The very real civilian casualties of the Ukrainian army's shelling of cities had been killed by that very weapon, the Grad. The Russian Grads labeled For Children and Mothers probably killed children and mothers in their turn. Yevgeny Trundayev of the 200th Motorized was killed in action in Ukraine and posthumously decorated as a hero of Russia. His comrades took part in the victorious campaign for the Luhansk airport and then joined other Russian units in the decisive Battle of Ilovaisk, where much of the Ukrainian army was encircled and destroyed by Russian armor. Despite promises of safe passage, Ukrainian soldiers attempting to exit the pocket were killed. This Russian victory led to a truce at Minsk on September 5th. It specified only that foreign forces withdraw. Since Moscow denied that Russian troops were in Ukraine, it interpreted this provision as requiring no action. Russian soldiers remained in Ukraine after the Minsk agreement and new ones were deployed. Some units that had seen combat during the August invasion were rotated out to the camps at the Russian-Ukrainian border or to their bases, only to return to the war in Ukraine a few months later. In early 2015, Russian armed forces carried out a third major offensive on the territory of Ukraine. The initial objective was the Donetsk airport. After 8 months of combat and siege, the airport no longer existed as such. But its long defense by Ukrainian soldiers and members of paramilitary militias was symbolic on both sides of the border. Ukrainians called the defenders cyborgs, since they seemed to live on despite everything. So in Moscow, a decision was taken that these men had to die. After the airport was finally taken by overwhelming Russian force in mid-February, Ukrainian prisoners of war were executed. The second objective of Russia's January 2015 offensive was Debaltseve, a railway junction that linked the Donetsk and Luhansk regions. It was important to the functioning of the Russia-backed pseudo-states known as the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic. Among the Russian units fighting at Debaltseve was the 200th Separate Motorized Brigade, which had taken part in the August 2014 invasion. It was joined by two units based in Buryatia, a region inhabited by ethnic Buryats, most of whom are Buddhists, on the Russian-Mongolian border, about 6,000 kilometers from Ukraine. These were the 37th Motorized Infantry Brigade, based in Kyakhta, and the 5th Separate Tank Brigade, based in Ulan-Ude. Bato Dambayev, a soldier of the 37th Motorized, posted photographs on social media of the unit's journey from Buryatia to Ukraine and back. Local people in the Donetsk region joked about the indigenous Donbas Buryats. Everyone in the Donbas, whatever they thought about the war, was aware that the Russian army was involved. People who made such a joke could be for the Russians, or for the Ukrainian state, or indifferent. Photographs of Buryats cuddling puppies or playing soccer in Ukraine were widely circulated. For their part, the Buryats laughed at the Russian propaganda that denied their presence in Ukraine. Other propaganda they accepted as true. They saw their mission as it had been presented to them in the Russian media, to defeat killers of children. Though a second ceasefire was signed at Minsk on February 12, 2015, the Russian assault on Debaltseve continued. Once again, the agreement spoke of foreign forces, and Russia denied that its soldiers were in Ukraine. The fighting continued until the city was destroyed and the Ukrainian army was routed. As a Russian tank commander recalled, "They were breaking out of the pocket. They wanted to clear the road. They flee, and we have to crush them." These words were spoken by Dorzhy Batomunkayev, one of the tank drivers of the 5th Separate Tank Brigade, who suffered severe burns when his tank was hit during the battle. Other Russians and Ukrainian citizens fighting on the Russian side were killed and wounded in the battle for Debaltseve. But the vast majority of the casualties were encircled Ukrainian soldiers. And so the latest major Russian intervention in the Donbas ended, not surprisingly, in a military victory. Units of the Russian army remained in Ukraine, training locals and engaging in combat. The 16th Separate Special Forces Brigade of the GRU, for example, was stationed in Ukraine in 2015. At least three of its soldiers, Anton Savilyov, Timur Mamayusupov, and Ivan Kardopolov, were killed in action in Ukraine on May 5th. As a woman from Kardopolov's hometown presented the situation, "I don't know, they say on television that we are not at war, but guys keep coming home dead." This neighbor could contrast what she saw with her own eyes with what she saw on television. For most Russians most of the time, the essentials of the war were behind Surkov's dark glass. Russians were told by their media that the Donetsk People's Republic and Lugansk People's Republic were independent entities, while separatists admitted that they were dependent upon the Russian taxpayer. This meant, as one separatist leader put it, that a call from Moscow was viewed as a call from the office of Lord God himself. By Moscow, he meant Surkov. Media in the two republics followed instructions from Moscow to portray America as the source of fascist evil, to consult Dugin and Glazyov, and to give press credentials to European fascists. The suffering of Ukrainian citizens continued, with some 10,000 killed and about 2 million displaced. Russia's war against Ukraine was called a hybrid war. The problem with phrasings in which the noun war is qualified by an adjective such as hybrid is that they sound like war minus, when what they really mean is war plus. The Russian invasion of Ukraine was a regular war, as well as a partisan campaign to induce Ukrainian citizens to fight against the Ukrainian army. In addition to that, the Russian campaign against Ukraine was also the broadest cyber offensive in history. In May 2014, the website of Ukraine's Central Election Commission was rigged to display an image showing that a nationalist, who had in fact received less than 1% of the vote, had won the presidential election. Ukrainian authorities caught the hack at the last moment. Unaware that the hack had been spotted, Russian television transmitted the very same graphic as it announced, falsely, that the nationalist had been elected president of Ukraine. In autumn 2015, hackers attacked Ukrainian media companies and the Ukrainian railway system. That December, hackers brought down 3 transmission stations of the Ukrainian power grid, knocking out 50 substations and denying power to 250,000 people. In autumn 2016, hackers attacked the Ukrainian railway, seaport authority, treasury, and the ministries of finance, infrastructure, and defense. They also carried out a second and far more sophisticated attack on the Ukrainian power grid, bringing down a transmission station in Kyiv. This cyber war made no headlines in the West at the time, but it represented the future of warfare. Beginning in late 2014, Russia penetrated the email network of the White House, the State Department, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and multiple American non-governmental organizations. Malware that caused blackouts in Ukraine was also planted in the American power grid. Only in 2016, when Russian hacks entered American presidential politics, would Americans begin to pay attention. The most remarkable element of Russia's 2014 invasion of Ukraine was the information war, designed to undermine factuality while insisting on innocence. It, too, continued in the United States, with greater sophistication and more impressive results than in Ukraine. Ukraine lost the information war to Russia, in the sense that others did not understand Ukraine's predicament. In general, Ukrainian citizens did. The same cannot be said of Americans. Throughout the war in Ukraine, the Russian leadership engaged in implausible deniability, telling obvious lies and then daring the Western media to seek the facts. On April 17, 2014, Putin categorically denied the Russian presence in southeastern Ukraine in these terms. Nonsense. There are no Russian units in eastern Ukraine. No special services, no tactical advisors. All this is being done by local residents, and proof of that is that those people have literally removed their masks. The curious thing about this claim is that April 17th was the very day when Russia's special forces in Slovyansk indeed removed their masks and said the exact opposite. We are special forces from the GRU. On August 23rd, at the very height of the summer campaign, as Russian units began to close the circle on Ukrainian soldiers at Ilovaisk, Lavrov said, "We view all such stories of the presence of Russian troops as part of an information war." On August 29th, he claimed that photographs of Russian soldiers were images from computer games. Lavrov did not really mean that the facts were other than they seemed. He meant that factuality was the enemy. This was the case made by the Izborsk Club in its manifesto and by the Russian commander Antyufeyev before the summer invasion. Facts were information technologies from the West, and to destroy factuality was to destroy the West. Opinion polls suggest that the denial of factuality did suppress the sense of responsibility among Russians. At the end of 2014, only 8% of Russians felt any responsibility for events in Ukraine. The vast majority, 79%, agreed with the proposition that the West will be unhappy no matter what Russia does, so you should not pay attention to their claims. After all of the goading of Russians to fight in Ukraine, silent terror greeted the returning corpses. The families of the dead and wounded were told that they would not receive benefits from the state if they spoke to the press. The St. Petersburg branch of the Soldiers' Mothers Committee, which was keeping a list of the Russian war dead, was declared to be a foreign agent by the Russian government. The head of the Soldiers' Mothers Committee in Pyatigorsk 73 years old and diabetic, was arrested. Most of the journalists who reported on Russian casualties were beaten. By the end of 2014, Russian reporters did not,